From NPR and WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Remember in that email exchange between a Trump associate and Donald Trump Jr., the associate said there would be two Russians in an upcoming meeting. He'd send the names. Well, we know one was said to be a Russian government lawyer. And today we're learning the second person was a former Soviet intelligence officer who now lobbies for Russian interests in the U.S. And Yahoo News is also reporting that the president's legal team knew more than 3 weeks ago about that email chain setting up the meeting, which is raising the old question, what did the president know and when did he know it?
And is anyone talking about the Senate health care bill, one vote away from defeat? It's time now for our Friday Politics Roundtable, and joining us, Rick Klein, political director at ABC News. Hi there, Rick.
Good to be with you.
It's great to have you. And Jose Diaz-Balart, news anchor at Telemundo and NBC. Hi there, Jose.
What a pleasure to see you. Thanks.
Well, Rick, let's just start out with some tape from the president. Here he was in France yesterday, and he was asked, of course, about the meetings his son took. Here's what the president said.
It lasted for a very short period, and nothing came of the meeting. And I think it's a meeting that most people in politics probably would have taken.
Rick, how does that statement sound today when we know that there was a second person now in that meeting who was a former Soviet intelligence officer and a lobbyist for Russian interests in the U.S.?
This is a family-first defense that no longer squares with the fact. And I'll tell you, it is roiling the White House internally because of the factions there. There are aides and staffers who just can't understand how Donald Trump Jr. could have done this, and they can't understand the defense because you're right. Even President Trump's own selection for the FBI said, to delete the FBI, said this is not an appropriate meeting to take, that you should contact the authorities if you get a request like this. And we know that, according to the email, that Donald Trump Jr. thought this meeting was with a Russian government contact. It's as clear as black and white. And the president is straining credulity with his spin on this right now. And that's the problem, is that the stories had to shift, and even the shifts don't stand up.
Now, a conservative columnist, Charles Krauthammer, he has been a known critic of President Trump, but he writes in The Washington Post today, this is not hearsay, not fake news, not unsourced leaks. This is an email chain released by Donald Trump Jr. himself. The Trump defense, collusion as a desperate Democratic fiction designed to explain away a lost election, is now officially dead. Jose, though, is it? Jose?
Yes.
Oh, yes, there. Is it? I mean, it may be dead for, you know, most critics of President Trump, but is it officially dead?
Yeah, look, I don't think so. And by the way, anybody who deals with the Russian government and high government officials, representatives, friends of the government, you should not be surprised that there were former KGB or, intelligence officials. That is the group that the president of Russia hangs out with because he happens to be one. The fact that the Soviet Union is now Russia doesn't take away from the fact that Russia is run in many cases by former Soviet Union apartheid, operatives. So anyone who meets with someone who says the Russian government is interested in supporting you must know, whether they are new to politics or not, that that's probably going to be former Soviet Union intelligence-related officials, because that's what Yeltsin is.
Well, I just don't understand why, if these emails had gotten out and we know they had, why people aren't being more forthcoming in the White House, why they are letting this trickle out. There are more questions about Trump advisor and son-in-law Jared Kushner, because remember, it was his lawyers who found the email in June. He was copied on it. He was invited to the meeting. He went. And those lawyers then revised his security clearance. And he was then questioned by the FBI, we're reading. Given that, why isn't Jared Kushner saying to the rest of the White House, hey, we found this email? You know, this was in June. Why would Trump Jr. a week later still be claiming it was just a meeting about adoption?
And I wonder what Rick's thoughts are, because, I mean, yes, they're neophytes. Yes, they haven't been involved in politics. Yes, their concerns in the past were, you know, getting buildings and building structures and putting on successful Miss Universes and even The Apprentice. But even given that reality, it seems as though there are only so many things you can do and blame them on, well, yeah, I'm not politically savvy.
Rick, what do you think about that? That you know, we now know Kushner and his lawyers found this email in June. You think there would be an immediate meeting convened to say this is going to get to Donald Trump Jr.?
I think there are two other points of context, and Jose is exactly right about them being neophytes. But beyond that, the directive from the boss. He has said it on the record. He tweets it all the time. This is a witch hunt. There is nothing there. And that's the mentality, a bunker mentality sets in, where you have to minimize everything because it's all about some kind of broader point, a Democratic conspiracy. And secondly, I think there is a tendency in this story for them to try to put the best spin possible because of the kind of outlandish things that the president himself has said, that there were no contacts with the Russians. We now know that to be an utter falsehood, that there's no collusion. We now know at the very least that President Trump's son was willing to collude with a Russian government official, someone he thought was a government official. So as things happen, they continue to shade differences to avoid pulling off the Band-Aid.
And you know, something that strikes me as ironic is that if you are an American government official, a representative, a senator, the odds are you probably have met with representatives of the Russian government or, you know, allies of the Russian government, because they're all over the place in Washington, D.C. But what makes it even more unusual is that this person is saying, well, I was a neophyte. I don't deal in the world of politics. Yesterday in Paris, the president said, I've only been in politics for 2 years. And yet, in these 2 years, there have been more meetings with the Soviet or former Soviet and Russian intelligence officials, former intelligence officials, or friends or allies of those intelligence officials by these neophytes than maybe many opportunities by members of Congress or senators.
Well, there's still a vigorous defense of the Trump administration coming from, advisors of the president himself. Trump communications advisor Michael Caputo will testify today behind closed doors at the House Intelligence Committee. He lived in Moscow, did PR work for Russian media, was an advisor to former Russian President Boris Yeltsin. But he was on WBEN radio just yesterday mocking the critics of President Trump.
To all you resistance aficionados, if you want to go ahead and try to prosecute the son of the President of the United States on a misdemeanor campaign finance violation, I dare you.
Rick, respond to that, because I actually think he raises a good question. I mean, how likely is any sort of action? There's still this legal question out there.
There's a legal question. We also have the president having declared him innocent. Of course, he has oversight in some way over the special counsel. That's going to be up for the special counsel, and I think there's legality questions about even soliciting that information. But that air of political defiance, I've heard it from many Republicans. If this is the best that they've got, go for it. If all you're going to do as a Democrat, as a resistance member, is to fight Donald Trump over what he did or didn't do in the last election, bring it on. And I think that's a dangerous mentality, because these are very serious things that Bob Mueller is digging into. It's also what kind of leads to the talk of impeachment, which is the pace of that is quickened, along with talk of things like treason this week. I think that's getting ahead of where it is. But I also think there's a danger in this White House and in Republicans in saying nothing to see here, when clearly something has been seen that is worth exploring.
Well, I want to mention one last thing from this week. McClatchy News reporting that House and Senate Intelligence Committee investigators are looking into whether the Trump campaign digital team, which was overseen by Jared Kushner, helped guide the Russian voter targeting and fake news attacks against Hillary Clinton. Remember the claim of a child pornography ring at a pizza parlor? That was Russians, and it was picked up right by right-wing media. So they're looking into whether or not the Trump campaign helped guide and fake news. So there's a lot more shoes to drop. But with a couple minutes left, we have to talk about France and the fact that President Trump was there for the last couple of days. How do you think that trip went, Jose?
Look, I think it was interesting to watch him in the press conference yesterday, along with President Macron, when they asked him point blank, well, this is a city that you said is no longer safe and that the government can no longer protect the French citizens. What do you say now that you're here in Paris and by the president? And President Trump was, I think, very ably say, well, because now you have a new president, I think all things are going to work out well. But you know what? I think that what you say matters, and he's had some very harsh words against France, the French government, and even Paris. I think that his trip ended up being probably a little better than many expected it to be.
You know, I have to say, if both of you gentlemen were here in the studio with us, I'd be reaching across the table to shake your hands.
It's all shaking
strongly, and I would not let go.
Let go.
I would not let go. I mean,
I'd pat you on the back, too.
A little light note there. But, Rick, I mean, the president's relationship, for example, with Angela Merkel, frosty, to say the least. Yeah. I mean, how do you think Macron, the French president, handled this? And is he sort of providing an example in terms of Europe dealing with the United States? States.
Oh, I felt like I was watching mini Trump suddenly. And mm-hmm. and really surprising because, of course, he was President Obama's choice in the election. And President Trump seemed to endorse his rival. But this was a man, even down to the thumbs up signs and the handshakes and the body language, that seemed to be moving closer to the Trumpian view. And it seemed to me like he was positioning himself to be Donald Trump's best friend in Western Europe.
Well, they're calling him the Trump whisperer in Europe. And he could be the man who gets Donald Trump to rethink the climate change agreement and maybe even rethink Russia. Because remember, Macron was hacked, too. His election was hacked by the Russians. And he was the one who stood next to Putin and slammed him for it. So perhaps there could be some shift in attitude. Perhaps that is what Macron is doing. I love that, the Trump whisperer. We've been talking to Rick Klein, political director at ABC News, Jose Diaz-Balart, news anchor at Telemundo and NBC. How the time flies. So we'll take it up again next week. Thanks to you both.
Thank you so much.
Winter has come to HBO's Game of Thrones. Yes, I actually did say that. Season 7 premieres this Sunday, signaling the beginning of the end of a story filled with complex rivalries and grand allegiances.
The King of the North!
And the show's creators have confirmed that the series will wrap up with 13 more episodes. So joining us for a look ahead at this penultimate season is NPR TV critic Eric Deggans. Eric, thanks for being here.
Yeah, great to be back. I wanted to say great to be back in Valerian, but I'm just not that geeky yet.
Well, you've got 13 more episodes to achieve that goal here. Overall, how do you think the show's been holding up for the past 6 years?
Well, it's actually been interesting to sort of watch the evolution of this show. First of all, I think the show was sort of born at a perfect moment where TV was kind of exploding, and there was this sense of, can a TV show match sort of the epic sweep of a grand movie like Lord of the Rings? And then when they brought Game of Thrones in the early seasons, it was obvious it was sort of an anti-Lord of the Rings. It was much more violent. Mm-hmm. It was much more explicit in terms of sexuality. And it was a world where heroism was rewarded with death and dishonor and humiliation. And as the show has sort of moved towards its conclusion, all of that has started to change. And the characters that we sort of identify as at least the anti-heroes of the story have started to prosper. And, you know, one of my favorite characters to talk about this evolution is Peter Dinklage's character, Tyrion Lannister, the imp, you know, a dwarf who started out as sort of people used to make fun of him and he drank too much, but he has now become the right hand to one of the main contenders for the Iron Throne. And we have a great clip that sort of shows him confronting somebody who used to make fun of him when he was down on his luck. And now that he's at the right hand of this very powerful ruler, the situation has changed. Let's check out this clip.
Everyone who makes a joke about a dwarf's height thinks he's the only person ever to make a joke about a dwarf's height. The height of nobility, a man of your stature, someone to look up to. You're all making the same 5 or 6 jokes.
It was a long time ago.
It was. And how have things been going for you since then?
Not well.
No.
Fans of the show, no. Not well. But basically, as the show has progressed, we've seen characters like Tyrion and Sansa Stark, who were victims and victimized. The worm is turning, and they are becoming the power players here. So it'll be interesting to see a more conventional, more heroic story, I think, kind of play out in these last 2 seasons of Game of Thrones.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I wonder, it is HBO's most popular program. Once Game of Thrones is over, you know, what's HBO going to do without it? Or will we be seeing spinoffs?
Yeah, what's HBO going to do to drop 25 million viewers a week? That's a really good question. That's a really good question. Well, you know, they have a lot of things that they're kind of developing. I think it's unrealistic to expect that they're going to not have another series that knocks it out of the park the way Game of Thrones does. You know, they didn't come up with a successor to The Sopranos right away.
Right.
And so I think it may take them a few years to find that next series that's going to hit a sweet spot. As long as they don't do something like Vinyl, they just stay away from that show, I'd be happy.
Well, what about a spinoff, a potential Game of Thrones spinoff?
Yeah, well, that's the other thing is that, you know, news has come out that they are developing ideas for 4 possible shows that would actually be prequels to Game of Thrones. They can't offer any guarantees. They're working on the idea, because to have a franchise this successful and not try to spin it off wouldn't make any sense.
Now, Eric, while we have you, I just want to ask one more question about a completely different program, because it has to do with Hollywood and diversity and equity. Because we've learned that Daniel Day Kim and Grace Park, two Asian American actors on CBS's Hawaii Five-0, have actually left because they were being paid less than their white co-stars. I mean, this is a problem with both race and gender. Of course, it's dogged Hollywood for a long time. Do you think they did the right thing?
Well, I mean, only they can say whether or not they did the right thing. I am pulling together a column on this myself, and I've talked to people at CBS and representatives for some of the actors involved. And, you know, they tried to bring Daniel Day Kim's pay in particular in line with the leads of the show, Alex O'Loughlin and Scott Kahn. But the bottom line is, when they created the show, they followed the template of the old Hawaii Five-0 show, which was basically two white cops in Hawaii surrounded by a racially diverse cast. And so what they should have done was, when they created the show, they should have made one of the two lead characters somebody who wasn't a white male. And they would have brought sort of Hawaiian culture closer to the heart of the show. And they would have offered something that was even a better reboot, something that was more representative of the times that the show was airing in. I always feel like this is the legacy of creating shows that don't recognize diversity when you develop them.
Right.
It's very hard to add it later. It's very hard to equalize things after the show gets rolling. And so this should be a lesson to CBS that as they're creating shows, they have to make them diverse in terms of race and gender, so that years down the line, if the show's a success, they don't find themselves looking terrible trying to equalize things in a way that, frankly, isn't very easy to do.
Mm-hmm. NPR TV critic Eric Deggans. Eric, thanks as always.
Always a pleasure.
Well, if you're hoping to stream Game of Thrones and you live in a rural part of the country, you may be out of luck, because the internet is notoriously slow and spotty in remote and rugged regions across the nation. For years, internet providers have resisted building the infrastructure to connect people in these more sparsely populated areas. Federal lawmakers are trying to encourage the spread of broadband into the countryside by setting aside billions of dollars in funding. Anne-Elise Henzel of Here and Now contributor WUWM talked with business owners and residents of rural northern Wisconsin. She has our story.
I met April Roski at the Logging Museum in Rhinelander, a small city in northern Wisconsin. It's in the heart of forested areas where in the 18 and early 1900s, lumber companies chopped trees and transported them to Milwaukee and Chicago.
This is a steam hauler. And as you can see, you know, it's like a tractor with a steam engine.
While parts of Roski's days are steeped in the past, she also relies on a computer, but she can't depend on the internet service.
It's just unbelievable. You're constantly being kicked out of your computer, no matter what you do. It just says, you know, Internet Explorer, stop working. Goodbye.
Roski says her internet provider tells her too many people are using the system.
So I do it 10, 11, 12 o'clock at night and still have that same problem.
Fred Bauman, who lives 20 miles northeast in the small town Three Lakes, shares Roski's irritation. He says his internet is too slow and unpredictable for him to work from home. Yet Bauman says the lack of high-speed service is more than an inconvenience. It's also a barrier. He works for a healthcare company and says some of its customers aren't able to use electronic health records.
One of the requirements is that there's online access. People can go to a patient portal, access their test results, check their appointments, and any other transactions that don't require touching your provider. But you have to have the broadband to do that.
Some Wisconsin residents try to find ways around the unreliable service. They might get internet from a satellite, although it's costly and not completely reliable. Others use their cell phones heavily if they're in areas where they can get a strong signal. TV ads promoting data plans are in heavy rotation. This one features Green Bay Packers coach Mike McCarthy.
The cell phone coverage is great up here. The 4G flows like a river. Coach McCarthy.
Meanwhile, Phil Heitmanek, who can't get decent service at his lakeside home, is trying to get a small tower built in the vicinity. The tower would send a broadband signal from a regional service provider to nearby houses.
It's kind of like electricity in the 1920s. You know, the people in town had it, the people out on the farm didn't, and pretty soon the people on the farm were unable to do their job without it, and so we had to make an effort to bring that technology out to those folks.
And it's not that internet service companies aren't doing anything to expand high-speed access. It's just taking time and money. The FCC has allocated nearly $9 billion nationwide to states around the country through the year 2020 for rural broadband expansion with its Connect America program. More than $95 million per year is going to Wisconsin. But some say the solution doesn't just require money. It also takes imagination. Don Sadlowski is with the Northwoods Broadband and Economic Development Coalition. He says because Wisconsin has lots of rural expanses and lakes, there's no one-size-fits-all answer.
We call it the creative patchwork quilt of solutions. You're going to have some wire, you have some wireless, some of it's going to be DSL, some of it's going to be cable, some of it's going to be fiber. But you got to take what you can get, where you can get it in a rural area, and recognize that there's going to be no universal solution.
Sadlowski says the solution will require another 5 to 10 years before, quote, every nook and cranny in Wisconsin has high-speed internet. The progress can't come soon enough for Governor Scott Walker. He says high-speed internet is key to the state's businesses, many who compete globally. For Here and Now, I'm Annalise Hensel.
And we want to check in on Brexit, the UK plan to leave the EU, the European Union. This week, members of the EU's European Parliament said Prime Minister Theresa May was offering workers from the EU second-class citizenship under her Brexit plan, a sign they're going to reject what they called her damp squib opening offer in the divorce negotiations. BBC economics correspondent Andrew Walker's in London, and Andrew, damp squib sounds like an insult. Remind us what this worker issue is about.
It's about the extent to which people who are living here in the UK from other European Union member states, and indeed Brits living abroad, the extent to which they will have the same rights that they currently have. Under the European Union treaties as they stand, people can simply move abroad to other EU member states to get work. They can also move to retire, as quite a few Brits have done in Spain. And the European Parliament, and indeed some other European Union negotiators, think that the offer that Britain has made in respect of other EU nationals living here, they think it's deficient, particularly in terms of the extent to which they will have rights to bring family members over and the extent to which they will be in a position to move abroad again for a period and then come back.
Well, that wasn't that at the heart of the matter for many who voted for Brexit. They felt, and it might have been a false perception in some cases, but they felt that it was foreign workers, Polish workers, I believe, who were coming in to take their jobs. So isn't she doing what the voters want?
There undoubtedly are some people who would like to see many of the European nationals who are already here losing some of those rights. But I think many people who voted for Brexit, I think, would like to give the message that those who are already here and settled here are welcome to stay. And that's a message that Theresa May herself has been giving many times.
We understand another point of friction is who will judge many of these issues of citizens' rights. The EU wants the Luxembourg court to have a central role, and Theresa May wants to end any EU jurisdiction.
Yes, that's right. In a speech she gave at the Conservative Party conference last year, Theresa May did say that one of the things, features of the departure from the European Union, one of the things she set out as essentially a red line was that there should be no continuing jurisdiction for the Court of Justice of the European Union. And of course, you do need to have some sort of legal system to deal with disputes about the rights of people who have moved across borders. The British position, I think, is that that can be done adequately by the British courts. The European Union negotiators don't think that's good enough.
Yeah. Look, we said that the European Parliament called Theresa May's first offer a damp squib. I understand that is a firecracker with a wet fuse.
Indeed.
So it didn't go anywhere. What's your sense that it is ever going to go anywhere? Are people talking about maybe Brexit not happening?
One view that you do certainly hear is the idea that it'll be so difficult for the British government to muster support in Parliament for any particular specific deal that we might simply end up unable to nail anything down. But having said that, the majority view is still very much this is going to go ahead, it is going to happen, but there's plenty of debate about the precise form.
BBC economics correspondent Andrew Walker in London. Andrew, thank you.
It's my pleasure.
Prepare for the worst. That's how an Illinois congressman felt coming out of an emotional meeting he and the Congressional Hispanic Caucus had this week with Secretary of Homeland Security John Kelly. They met to discuss the future of temporary protected status for immigrants from countries such as Haiti and Honduras, and the DACA program, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, first put in place by President Obama in 2012. Kelly warned that more than a million people living in the U.S. under these programs could soon face deportation, a significant shift in tone for the Secretary of Homeland Security, who previously voiced support for DACA. Congressman Luis Gutierrez, Democrat from Illinois and chair of the Immigration Task Force for the Congressional Hispanic Caucus, joins us now. And Congressman, you came out of that meeting saying that you're actually in fear for people. So what exactly did Secretary Kelly tell you that led you to that conclusion?
Well, okay, so let's take temporary protective status. He said, I've already notified 57,000 Haitians that their temporary protective status is going to continue for 6 months and to put their affairs in order. You know, to extrapolate from that to hundreds of thousands of Central American is not far. And he basically said to us, listen, it's not that bad in Haiti, and people can return to Honduras and Nicaragua and El Salvador. I felt like telling him, yeah, those are murder capitals of the world, and I guess people can. And I guess everything just must be hunky-dory back in Haiti. Of course, when the secretary went there, he never left his hotel room.
If I may just jump in, Congressman,
very, very
in June, the secretary did say that he was going to extend TPS for Haitians.
For six months.
To January, yes, to give them time
to
make
whatever
changes.
Right.
And I do want to come back to TPS in just a second.
Sure.
But I don't want to get the programs confused here.
Okay.
Because it's his views on DACA and what he told you about DACA that I'd love to hear more on. I mean, what did he tell you? Because the secretary beforehand has said that he personally supports the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals.
Oh, he bemoaned the fact that he was powerless, that he had no ability to change anything, how much he really cared for these hundreds of thousands of young people that had come to legalize their status in the United States, but that ultimately in September this would be in the hands of Jeff Sessions, the Attorney General, to which I responded, you know, there were 67 senators in the summer of 2013 that approved comprehensive immigration reform in the Senate, and the chief architect of the opposition was none other than Jeff Sessions. So given that, and then, look, I want to be real clear. I gave the secretary an opportunity to clarify. I turned around to 20 of my colleagues in the Hispanic Congressional Caucus, and I said, I hope you understand what the secretary has just shared with us. The program is ending in September, and we have to mobilize and organize and get our community ready. 800,000 people are at risk of becoming illegal in the United States.
But isn't Secretary Kelly technically right that the Trump administration does have until the 5th of September to decide if it will phase out DACA or not? And if they don't, it's very likely that the administration will face a court challenge from Republican leaders of several states.
You know, here's what the secretary said. I'd love to, if there was only legislation, of course, we turned around and said, can the secretary actually be that ill-informed that there is no legislation to make the status permanent for the Dreamers? I mean, he's not putting up a fight. One of the best ways to lose a fight in the court is never show up in the court. And by handing this over to Jeff Sessions, he's basically abdicating his responsibility as Homeland Security. And the law is very clear. It gives him broad discretionary powers to protect certain immigrants in the United States of America. And he's not doing that. This administration is going to collude with the former Attorney General of Texas, now governor. They've always wanted to revoke.
Congressman, I mean, collusion is a very loaded and strong term right now. And you know as well as I do that Democratic administrations have worked with states before on issues that they advocate for. I'm not quite sure how this is any different. But I want to get back to what you said about what Secretary Kelly can or can't do. I mean, specifically, what would you like him to do come September 5th? Do you want him to walk to the Justice Department and tell Attorney General Sessions, I'm not going to take any action if you decide not to renew DACA? I mean, what do you want him to do?
Look, he is the one that has articulated his support for the program. He basically told us at the meeting, oh, if it weren't for me, as though we were supposed to pat him on the back and thank him, that they hadn't been deported already. So understand one thing. He repeatedly said at the meeting that the executive order of the President of the United States was illegal. And so he's already made a determination.
Well, you know, I'm seeing a statement here from Department of Homeland Security Press Secretary David Lappin, who says that he says from the secretary's point of view, what he told you was informed by conversations he's had with attorneys inside and outside DHS, and that they're the ones who are telling him that they feel that as DACA exists, it's not legally sustainable.
Sure. Attorneys that were hired by Donald Trump. Look, the Supreme Court looked at President Barack Obama's executive orders. It was a tie, 4-4, right? Mm-hmm. So I know of 4 Supreme Court justices who think it's perfectly legal.
Well, let's talk for a second then about the potential court challenge that the administration faces. Because as you've mentioned, last month, a group of Republican state officials from 10 states, led by the Texas Attorney General, they've called on the president to stop the DACA program. They could challenge it in court. Now, I mean, granted, it is possible that the Trump administration won't defend DACA in court, but we have seen this happen before. If the Trump administration declines to present a defense for DACA, perhaps Congress can. I mean, could you not, or someone in Congress provide the legal defense and give it a chance in court?
Look, let's be very clear. The Republican majority in the House and in the Senate, the one thing that unites them and in which they are always together is on their anti-immigrant position. They have gone so far to the right. Just think about it. In 2004, Congressman Jeff Flake, now Senator Flake, and I introduced a comprehensive immigration reform bill with Senator Kennedy and Senator McCain. Okay. Bipartisan, bicameral. You know, one of the chief sponsors of the legislation? None other than Speaker Ryan. And today, Chief Speaker Ryan has just turned his back on the very principles and the very views that he held, or longstanding views that he held. Why? Because he's held hostage by a small, radical, right-wing element in his party.
Yeah. You know, it is true that this could have an impact on hundreds of thousands of people, right?
We have
800,000.
800,000. All legally in this country. And I want the public to understand something. They are doctors today. They are teachers. I mean, they're part of our community. They've integrated. They've made lives here. And the government knows where they live, knows where they bank, knows every essential element of their life.
What are you hearing from DACA folks, from people who have temporary protected status? I mean, and what are you telling them?
The fear is so palpable. I went to Nixon Elementary School 2 weeks ago in Chicago, fifth grade. You know what the first question was? Congressman, if immigration agent knocks at my door, do I have to open it? Because my dad doesn't have papers. That's the question of a fifth grader in our community. And look, this is something that affects us all, especially in immigrant communities. And people tend to think, well, you got papers. You've been here a while. It doesn't impact you. Yeah, guess what? You don't go to the local dance and ask the girl when you ask her out to dance whether she has documents or not. You know, love doesn't quite work that way.
So final question for you, Congressman. As you know, earlier this year, the president himself promised to treat dreamers with heart. That's his phrase, right? Mm-hmm. And he called, you know, a lot of the people we're talking about, he called them incredible kids. I mean, do you hold hope, or maybe are you calling on the president himself to step in and make a decision about DACA? And do you think that's still possible?
This can be resolved in minutes. The fact is, the House of Representatives passed the DREAM Act in November of 2012. The fact is that there are enough senators already that have co-sponsored DREAM legislation in the past and enough members in the House to pass it. Do they have the courage to take on their extreme radical right? Do they have the courage to do that? Does Donald Trump have the courage to turn around and say, you know what? Maybe they're all not murderers, rapists, drug dealers. Maybe there's a few good ones, and I found some of them.
Well, Luis Gutierrez is a Democratic representative from Illinois. Congressman Gutierrez, thank you so much for speaking with
us. Thank you.
Wimbledon is underway at the All England Lawn Tennis Club in London. An exciting year for American tennis fans. For the first time since 2009, an American man, 29-year-old Sam Querrey, has made it to a Grand Slam semifinal, and Venus Williams has made it to the singles finals. And Mark Cuban is watching on the sidelines, but he's in Iowa. Let's explain. Remember Field of Dreams, in which Iowa farmer Kevin Costner builds a baseball field in his cornfield and people, including the ghosts of players past, came out of the corn stalks to play?
If you build it, you will come.
Well, Mark Cuban built a pretty exact replica of Wimbledon's center court at his family's corn and soybean farm in Charles City, Iowa, on an old cow feedlot. Mark, do they come?
Yes, they come at all hours of the day and night, and we're glad to welcome them to the All-Iowa Lawn Tennis Club.
It's called the All-Iowa Lawn Tennis Club. It's right there on what used to be this feedlot, you know, on what looks like a beautifully prosperous big farm. But there it is, right in the middle. And you say people come at all hours. You charge them? How does it work?
No, we don't. We're just happy to share grass court tennis with them. And it's a real rarity in the United States. There's fewer than about 100 courts. Most of them are on the East Coast, mm-hmm. and most of them are in private clubs. So it's a real opportunity for people who've been watching Wimbledon all their lives to come hit a few on the lawn and... Mm-hmm. We've gotten guests from all over America and the country, really. We just got our guest from Mississippi, who makes 43 states, and just recently someone come from Colombia. And so now we've got guests from seven countries. It's amazing.
It is amazing. It's amazing that you did this, too. What a gift. You don't charge people. They just have to have a reservation. They can play at all hours. And we read this all started because of what sounds like a wonderful grandfather. You'd go to his house and you'd, what, hear Wimbledon on the radio?
Yes. Instead of riding home on the school bus, I would walk over to my grandfather's house and my mother would pick me up and take me home later. But he had a shortwave radio and he... would take me all over the world. We would hear ships at sea and various things. And one day we were listening to the BBC, and we came across the broadcast of Wimbledon. It was in 1960.
And that's when the dream, it sounds like, began. But then to do this thing. Now, let's remind people, this is, as you said, it's a lawn. It's grass. So how did you know how to do this exact recreation?
Well, it took a long time before we finally... followed up on the dream that started in 1962, actually, when I came up with the idea. I was feeding the cattle on the feedlot and having some problems getting my sister's horse, who I took care of, to drink. And while I was standing at the trough, I was looking around, and I said, boy, this is a perfect place for a grass tennis court. And I remember walking it off after I got the horse put away and wow, this is going to be great, and then telling my parents what I wanted to do. And you might imagine that they didn't meet it with the same enthusiasm that I had. But some 50 years later, we consulted with turf grass specialists at Iowa State University. And, of course, they tried to dissuade me. I remember what they said, do you know how hard it will be to maintain? And I said, I'm a farmer. And literally, we did. They helped with the design, but we did all the work. There are tile lines underneath the court. It's irrigated. And through a lot of trial and error, it took a long time, but we've got a grass tennis court.
Well, we also understand you did an internship with Wimbledon's ground staff. You went there.
Yes, I was really fortunate. I spent 8 days prior to the start of the 2012 championships working with the ground staff, and it was a marvelous experience. I even learned how they converted the court that year. There was the Olympics was played at Wimbledon in 2012, and they only had 21 days between the end of the championships and the start of the Olympics. And that was actually very helpful this year because I had to pre-germinate ryegrass seed. I only this year converted from bent grass to ryegrass, which is grown at Wimbledon. So I was pre-germinating ryegrass seed in my shower in the house, and it really worked quite well. And after about 8 days, I got these little sprouts on the end of these tiny seeds, and I'd go out and by hand sprinkle them in some of the areas that hadn't grown from the previous year. And so it worked very well, and that was something I learned over there in 2012.
What a labor of love. We'll put pictures at herenow.org. It's got the white picket fence around. It looks just like center court. Do you play?
Yes, I do. I played yesterday. A lot of people come by and they're looking for a fourth for the doubles, or occasionally they'll want a partner to hit with. So, yeah, I get in a fair amount of tennis, but I really spend more time taking care of the court and watering the flowers and hosting people than I actually do playing.
Well, thank you from all of us. Thank you. That's Mark Cuen, who created an exact replica of center court at Wimbledon at his family's farm in Charles City, Iowa. Mark, thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Robin.
Iowans never cease to surprise, Meghna. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Jeremy Hobson is back on Monday. This is Here and Now.